Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Democrats rail that the Republican Party's big donors have too much say in policy. Weekly Standard writer Jay Cost says, look in the mirror. He sees a Democratic Party beholden to a slew of embedded interests, unions, environmentalists, feminists, minorities, and for a long time, bankers too, he says. He calls them clients, says that's the problem. This hour on Point, special interests, party politics, and the Democratic Party. You can join the conversation, who's owned by whom here? And when you add up unions, environmentalists, feminists, teachers, minorities, maybe bankers, is that special interests or is that the country? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Jay Cost, a staff writer for the Weekly Standard. He's author of the new book, Spoiled Rotten, How the Politics of Patronage Corrupted the Once Noble Democratic Party and Now Threatens the American Republic. He's winning plaudits, maybe predictably, from big conservatives William Kristol, Rich Lowry, Jonah Goldberg, Moore, but also from The New Yorker's Nicholas Lemon, who calls Spoiled Rotten the biggest, meatiest available conservative take on American politics, and writes liberals would do well to read Cost's book. Jay Cost, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Doesn't everybody have a base? Doesn't everybody have special interests? We certainly see, you know, a lot of people parade into the, let's say, the White House to talk with Dick Cheney about big oil. Is a Democrat special in this regard, Jay?
Well, I don't know if they're special, but they certainly have a problem. And I would probably answer your question by, you know, seeing the basic point that, yes, everybody has a base. And it's a great challenge of American political parties. And it has been since the party system began back in the late 18th century to balance the needs of the base, the sort of the voters who keep the party functioning year in and year out, with the needs of the whole country. Because, of course, the purpose of political parties in our system is to acquire control of the government, to govern everybody. So there's an inherent tension there that has been existent in party politics since the start of the constitutional system.
We're going to look at your argument about the Democratic Party, but didn't the founders themselves, I mean, and on through Madison and the rest, I mean, they saw danger in faction, but at the same time, I mean, these were great realists. Didn't they anticipate that all kinds of interests would stand up and try and, you know, gain a foothold in the political system, and that it would be ultimately the whole concert of interests wrestling with one another that would determine the national interest?
Yeah, they did. That's, of course, Madison's argument, Federalist Number 51. Mm-hmm. And they were great realists in many respects. But my contention is that they overlooked the inevitability of political parties as an organizing force of political life in a democracy. And because they didn't anticipate political parties, they did not set up any rules or instructions on how to deal and manage political parties. And so what the parties basically do is that if the constitutional system separates power, disperses power, the political parties are really there to concentrate it to make the government function. And the problem, in my opinion, is that when clients or interest groups control a political party, and that party then manages to acquire control of the government, those interests can, in fact, dominate the government despite the constitutional protections that Madison, Hamilton, and his cohorts put in place.
You've got a very big list that you, from your perspective, are kind of hanging around the neck of the Democratic Party and saying, these are your clients and you're too beholden to them and they're driving your policy in a way that doesn't serve the national interest. Well, look at that and put it up against GOP interest. But let's hear the case. Who are the clients that you attribute to the Democrats?
Well, it's been a list that's sort of grown over the last 80 years. I mean, it started, the classic client group of the Democratic Party was, of course, the segregationist South, which was really part of the party coalition from the end of Reconstruction until the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And they've sort of slowly reformed themselves. long gone now. But, you know, you had organizations like Tammany Hall, which is, of course, gone as well. But the sort of machine-style politics still exists in many cities, like, for instance, Chicago.
But as you point out, FDR changed. Blew up Tammany Hall, right? That was
he did. He did blow up Tammany Hall. He blew it up
Democrat.
Because – Yeah, he blew it up because Tammany Hall had backed Al Smith in the 1932 nomination, and Roosevelt was worried about securing renomination in 36. So similarly, he destroyed Tammany Hall, but he actually created the new machine in the city of Pittsburgh, for instance, supported the Chicago machine, the San Francisco machine, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt also adds organized labor into the coalition, which had previously been sort of a free-floating player in American politics. But with the National Labor Relations Act, really comes on as a party interest group, and a very durable one, at least as develops by the time Eisenhower is elected, organized labor solidly in place.
But in your big telling here, if I may, Jay, FDR is kind of the Rosetta Stone from your conservative perspective on the problem you're laying out. And in that, as you see it, he made a sort of deal with huge portions of the country that put them in the Democrats' pocket.
That's right. I would juxtapose Roosevelt's tenure to Woodrow Wilson's tenure as sort of an instructive point. And of course, Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during Roosevelt's administration and saw what had happened to the Democrats, saw it firsthand, obviously, in 1920 as the vice presidential candidate. But what Wilson had done during his 8 years in office was really offer the first vigorous progressive program of national domestic reform, something that frankly had not been seen in the history of the country up to that point. But what Wilson had failed to do was transform historically Republican voters into Democrats. And so by the end of the decade, there's sort of the progressive impetus has sort of petered out. People are tired of war and terrorism at home, and so they're sort of free to float back to the Republican Party. And my contention is what Roosevelt did was he sort of, as he was continuing the Wilsonian project of broad national reforms to sort of save the country from the Great Depression and then to reform the political economic relations in the country, he also set about securing the Democratic Party. Because, of course, what Roosevelt did is really the most important act of party building in American history. I mean, when he takes office, the Democratic Party is largely a Southern conservative party in many respects. When you factor in the conservative Irish machines in places like New York and the Southerners was very conservative. But by the time he passes away in 1945, it really had begun to rebuild itself as a primarily Northern political party built on an enduring alliance between progressives, or as they came to be called, liberals, and organized labor. And the way he was able to do that is by using the power of this newly expanded government to build the party.
We're going to bring this all up today, but just take FDR for a minute. I mean, a lot of people are going to listen to that and say, well, you're describing that as kind of the root of a problem. Others might say, well, here's FDR. He brought in Social Security for everybody, saved the country from depression, you say, for all, reined in the banks, worked for everybody. You know, if that's the crime, was that so bad? Is that not the national interest?
Well, no. First of all, I wouldn't contend that any crimes were committed here.
I mean literal crime, but if that's your complaint, it's like,
in a broader moral sense. I mean, I don't think that there's anything wrong with what Roosevelt did. I mean, politicians, especially presidents, are leaders of their political parties, and they have a duty to their party to do their best to maintain a political majority over time. And I certainly wouldn't dispute that Roosevelt did a lot of great things for the country. And, you know, one of the things I tried to do in the book, as a conservative, to put aside my opinions about the proper size of government and sort of, you know, put that argument aside and really question, whether and how well the Democratic Party has become a vehicle for American liberalism. And I think what you see with the Roosevelt administration is a very good, politically good, balance between broad national programs like Social Security, but that are sort of included in many respects very smart party-building exercises, so that Roosevelt actually managed to do two things at once. He managed to govern for the whole country, and he managed to build his political coalition.
But then you turn around and you point to what you call loyal Democratic factions today, and you've got a lot of them. You're talking labor unions and teachers and government workers, feminists, African-Americans, environmentalists, and in total, you say, the way the party is interacting with these supporters ends up being a threat to the Republic itself. Why?
Right. Right. Well, what happens when you bring in, you know, client groups or interest groups into the party, they become part of the party itself. I mean, they end up having representation primarily in Congress, and then you have to deal with their interests.
But when you put all those interests together, that, I mean, the environment, we all share that. I mean, you put all these together, it's a big part of the country. How can it be a threat to the country when it's so much of it?
Right. Well, I would sort of contend that just adding up all of these individual interests does not yield a national interest. I think that would probably be a fallacy of composition. My contention is that by and large, Democratic leaders managed to balance these two goals. Like I said, these two goals that Roosevelt had as being the leader of the country and leader of the party, taking care of the interests within the party and then servicing the national interest. My contention is Democrats up through Lyndon Johnson managed to do both. And, you know, I mean, you can point to some of the, you know, unseemly political things that President, you know, Democratic presidents did. But, you know, frankly, all presidents have to do things like that because they're inherently politicians. My argument, though, is that around the time of the 1960s, there's just too many groups to take care of, and that's where things begin to change.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about political parties and interests. And one young conservative's charge that the Democratic Party is now the particular preserve of special interests, of clients. Jay Koss joins us from New York. He's a writer for the Weekly Standard. His new book is Spoiled Rotten, How the Politics of Patronage Corrupted the Once Noble Democratic Party and Now Threatens the American Republic. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Lemon in The New Yorker says liberals ought to read this book to get a sense of just how, through conservative eyeglasses, the world looks. And Jay Koss brings it on. So, Jay, bring us right up to the Obama administration and how you see this working, or maybe in your view, not working now.
Right. Well, for me, in my read of history, the first sign of trouble is really the Carter administration. You know, and it's I sort of have, at least as a conservative, I sort of have a heterodox view of the Carter tenure, that I see Carter as a reformer, as a sort of new kind of progressive in a lot of respects, who wants to adapt and modify American liberalism for what he called this new age of limits, right? Because, of course, inflation is running out of control and, you know, oil is suddenly becoming scarce, you know. And what Carter tries to do in particular is tame inflation by cutting, or at least attempting to cut, government spending, which was sort of a necessity considering the inflation rate, especially at the end of his tenure. And this is what really provokes a backlash from the groups that we've been talking about because, you know, sort of to summarize their unifying interest, to sort of borrow a phrase from Samuel Gompers, is what do they want? They want more. They want more government activism on their behalf. And so Carter was trying to do things like reform welfare, making it more efficient by keeping spending under control, you know, raising the minimum wage, but not nearly as much as organized labor wanted. He prompts this backlash from the left wing of the party, which culminates in, of course, the Ted Kennedy challenge in 1980. To me, that's the first sign of trouble. Under the Clinton administration, you know, Clinton is working very much in the idiom of Jimmy Carter, although obviously the rhetoric changes. But this sort of new Democrat kind of attempting to reform government from a progressive standpoint to make government work better. And during his first 2 years under the 103rd Congress, Clinton really has to adulterate much of his political program to appease the House Democrats, which is where I really think the locus of the problem is, at least in the Democratic Party. And it's really only after the 94 Republican Revolution, as conservatives like to call it at least, that you see Clinton successfully reimagining himself as a new Democrat, where he sort of compromises with the Republicans and stops the most conservative pieces of legislation, which of course he and liberals would consider draconian.
Does away with Glass-Steagall with Republican help. And
yeah, well,
we've got that
in
our lap.
That's a very good point. And that's one thing that Clinton really does is bring big business really starts to come into the party in a big way during the Clinton administration. I mean, there had been hints and shades of that during the 1980s. Tony Coelho at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee had done a very good job of recruiting business PAC money, professional PAC money sort of.
But that
kind of
out with Glass-Steagall era is what you point to as the beginning of a Democratic Party / banker condominium there, sort of a relationship that maybe isn't
yes.
so healthy, maybe isn't so bright today. We'll look at that. Bring us on up to Obama, if you would.
Well, under the Obama administration, I mean, Obama as a candidate really, in my opinion, is sort of searching around for the same language that I'm sort of discussing here. You know, for instance, his 2004 speech, the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, he talks about there being no red states and blue states, but a United States, sort of reading his second autobiography, The Audacity of Hope. You see he's sort of struggling to point beyond partisan politics toward a national purpose. My objection to the tenure of the Obama administration has not so much been the ideological content, at least. I mean, I certainly disagree with that, but it's not the point of the book. You know, I know Democrats want to do universal health care and things like that. My objection, rather, is how those bills were crafted. And I think that the mistake that the president made during the last Congress was he allowed the House Democrats to be the prime movers in most of the big legislation.
What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem with that is that the House of Representatives is really where these problems persist. I mean, this is where you have a lot of, you know, the organized interests have done a very good job of sort of winning over congressional Democrats and congressional Republicans, which, you know, we should need to talk about because their hands aren't
clean.
And
we will. But what's the evidence that that's a problem in the House? I mean, take us down to some particulars that would make your case that this is a problem and not just representing American people.
Right. Sure. Well, I think the for me the inspiration of the book was really the healthcare bill and the way in which the bill ultimately was drafted and the sort of deals that they made to get the bill across the finish line. This is not a left-right critique. I actually thought the bill was a much better bill when it had the so-called public option. At least from a non-ideological standpoint.
So did some Republicans.
A lot of sense. Yeah. What happens, though, is, you know, a lot of these health care interest groups, which are very numerous and had recognized that, you know, in 2008 had read the tea leaves, seen that the Democrats were on the rise and that they were inevitably going to focus on health care. So they upped their contributions. And they did that in large part because they didn't want something like a public option. They do not want to compete with the government, the insurance companies, the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, and so on and so forth. And you can see very early, I mean, there was this whole, debate that dragged on even into late 2009 about will there or won't there be a public option. But to my reading, it was really just a kabuki dance. It was never going to happen. The president had hinted as early as the spring of 2009 that there were other ways to follow. And so for me, you know, my read of, you know, history and my read of the Democratic Party is, you know, I look at an individual mandate such as is in the current bill without a public option. Mm-hmm. And I see that a Democratic Party basically mandating citizens to engage in commerce with for-profit enterprises. And I wonder to myself, what would Harry Truman think of that? What would Franklin Roosevelt? What would Andrew Jackson think of that? And that was something that was done because of the interest groups that are sort of become very powerful within the Democratic Party.
And you're talking there about
Congress.
Big health industry groups as clients.
Yes. But we, or as a kind of client. I mean, it's sort of a subtle, you know, and the thing about businesses, of course, is businesses are not ideological in character. They just are interested in access. So they play both sides. I think the real problem has been, like I said, in the last 25 years or so, the Democrats have really opened up their doors to these business PACs and these sort of influence peddlers.
Hey, Jay, let me ask you. I mean, I can hear and I can see in the comments coming in online, you know, a whole lot of foreheads being slapped here. John says, you know, I guess satirically, says, I'm so glad the Republicans don't cater to the no new taxes ever crowd, to Christian extremists, to oil companies, to NRA members. And you know, people saying, what are you talking about, Jay Koss? As if this is just a Democratic Party problem? And then you know, we've got others saying, hey, you know, wait a minute, what about super PACs, GOP super PACs outspending 10 to 1 Dems so far in this election cycle? Is there really a problem on one side of the scales here that you don't see in equal measure on the other, Jay?
Well, no, I wouldn't contend that.
Parties are out to sink the Republic? Is that your...
Well, I think both parties are very troubled organizations now. You know, I mean, I have not done a careful study of the Republican Party like I have the Democratic Party. I mean, I wrote the book about the Democratic Party in large part because of, you know, the founding principles on which the party was, you know, formed in the 1820s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that Jackson actually forms this political party to stop this very kind of behavior. And now here I see the Democrats in the contemporary era really sort of falling prey to it. I would not contend for a second that the Republican Party doesn't have its own problems. And in fact, Tom, I mean, the Republicans were really the originators of this problem. I mean, you can go back and look at Republican economic policy in the 19th century, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, this sort of tension between national purpose and payoffs. I mean, the Republicans of the 19th century subscribed to the Hamiltonian, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln economic ideology of protective tariffs to grow industry. However, the tariff system, the tariff regime had been perverted in a way by the Republican Party, had been perverted in a way to pay off wealthy industrialists in the Northeast who would turn around and donate, you know, gobs of money to Republican, you know, congressional candidates.
Yeah.
And
Jay,
the tariffs.
I just want to share because we've got just comment pouring in here. And it's interesting because it comes from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But here's Cody, and she writes on Facebook, you know, though some special interest groups reflect the ideals of the Democratic Party, many of them don't. She writes, that's why many liberal-minded people, including the Occupy movement, don't describe themselves as Democrats. The money is silencing. A Democrat in Washington can't denounce the atrocities of big banks, for example, when they're actively receiving funding from them. So you've got some Democrats who are not entirely happy with this as well, though I don't know if they would point that same critique at unions and teachers and environmentalists, Jay.
Right. Well, I think that the book is not meant to be an argument against American liberalism. I mean, the idea, the progressive ideals that were first articulated by people like Herbert Crawley, I'm not arguing against that at all. My sort of contention here is liberalism for whom? And that I hope people who read the book who disagree with my ideological politics would take it as a sort of encouragement for party reform. And frankly, I think both parties are in massive need of reform. I think they're, you know, both approaching a level of moral bankruptcy, the likes of which we haven't seen in a very long time.
Jay Koss' book is Spoiled Rotten, How the Politics of Patronage Corrupted the Once Noble Democratic Party and Now Threatens the American Republic. He joins us from New York. Jay, I want to turn to Nashville, Tennessee right now. And Mark Hetherington, he's a professor of political science at Vanderbilt University, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization, Why Trust Matters. Mark Hetherington, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you make of Jay's long, meaty, as Nick Lemon says here, argument that you now have a Democratic Party that is the prisoner of clients and that is sort of shifting it off of the national interest into something more narrow? We've got lots of listeners saying, okay, but doesn't it go both ways? And Jay says the same in many ways. But what about the basic argument, Mark?
Well, I think the basic argument is right, but I don't know how different it is from how politics always has been. You know, political parties on one level or another have always been about bringing different groups together to make majorities. And part of bringing groups together is giving them things to cause them to vote the way that you want them to vote. So in that sense, I think what we're talking about is politics. Now, one of the things that is different about today is the amount of money, just raw money that's involved in the process. Part of that has to do with changes in the campaign finance system, and part of it has to do with changes in the media system that require a tremendous amount of money to run things. So, you know, I think as long as Jay is willing to suggest that, boy, you know, the Republicans have always engaged in this, and the Democrats have increasingly turned to muddied interests and somewhat away from broader-based interests, we're probably on the same page. But, you know, the idea that we're only going to explore one side of the political divide and the problems that it has strikes me as being somewhat problematic.
Mark, let me put this to you. This is from Robbie, a listener online, says, special interests are inevitable. However, it's turned into legalized bribery, and our democracy is being prostituted for the benefit of the highest bidder. Is that also, it's ever been thus, kind of a observation, Mark? Or do you see a problem that is worse now than historically?
Well, the number of dollars, you know, at this point suggest that it's worse. And I'll say two things. One is, if times were better, if the economy was rolling and things like that, people wouldn't care so much. You know, part of this, you know, sort of critique of the American political system has a lot to do with, you know, 4 or 6 years of bad times. But, you know, I think it's important to listen to the people about things like this. One of the things that has developed over the course of the last 3 or 4 years is the lowest levels of trust in government that we've ever seen since we've been asking survey questions about it since the 1950s. And a huge part of why we have those low levels of trust in government is exactly this perception that the political system is bought and paid for, whether it's for Democratic client groups that Jay suggests or Republican client groups like the pharmaceutical industry or big oil or the very well off. When ordinary people don't feel like government is doing things to solve their problems, I think we have a real problem as far as the ability of leaders to accomplish what they seek to accomplish.
Jay Cost here, a couple of people on Twitter writing to us. One says, you know, looking at the list of factions that you describe, clients of the Democratic Party, says that's a rather long list. Doesn't that effectively include a majority of the country? Then another, Tom, writes to us, one must not confuse the interests of the people with the interests of corporate groups. Feminists, etc., Tom writes to us, Jay, represent people.
Right. Well, I would sort of argue from a purely mathematical standpoint, it doesn't amount to half of the country. But I think that there's a broader point to be made here, and I alluded to it earlier, is sort of the idea of aggregating the interests of, you know, half plus one of the country does not equal the national interest. I mean, it's the same reason why the House of Representatives is not actually a national body. There's nobody within the House of Representatives who represents the whole country, right? And so, and it like I said, it's a fallacy of composition to assume that just because you add up to half plus one, you have the public interest. The public interest is something bigger than even that.
But who defines that? I mean, you might say you think you know what it is, but wouldn't that be colored by your own ideological view of the world? Isn't that the point of the founders? There's no one person who can define the national interest. That'd be a monarchy or dictatorship. A democracy is exactly this contest of interests and perspectives.
Right. No, I certainly don't disagree with that. You know, and you know, like I said, my argument in the book is sort of that the Democratic Party has really not been able to, you know, when it gets complete control of the government, has not been able to serve the public interest, this national interest. So it's a sort of very tricky problem of definition. And, you know, the way I approached it was just a case by case basis. I mean, when we talk in the abstract about the national interest, it seems very ephemeral. But, you know, if you look at the year 1978, for instance, there's no doubt what the national interest was in 1978. It was to get inflation under control. That was clearly the point of Jimmy Carter, what he was trying to do. And similarly, in 1992-93, there was, like we have now, a sort of breakdown in trust. And that sort of points to what Clinton's purpose was as a new Democrat trying to reform liberal institutions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about political parties and interests. And one young conservative's charge that the Democratic Party is now the particular preserve of special interests, of clients. Jay Cost is a writer for the Weekly Standard. He's out with a new book, Spoiled Rotten, How the Politics of Patronage Corrupted the Once Noble Democratic Party and Now Threatens the American Republic. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from New York. And from Nashville, Mark Hetherington is with us, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization. Jay, Mark, we've been keeping our callers waiting, and I'm going to go right to them. But, Jay, let me just give you a few comments from online here. Mac writes, labor, feminists, environmentalists, minorities are suddenly the big bad guys. He says, what is this guy smoking? And the Democrats are crippled by their associations with them. They haven't all signed a pledge to these special interests in order to get elected. He writes, meanwhile, the Republicans are so clearly the stooges of Grover Norquist, the Koch brothers, big oil, and bigoted anti-science religious right. I'll take the unions, feminists, and environmentalists over that crowd any day. There's that one. Mark writes, the disparity of monetary influence is your point. But who do you consider the people? So the people are minority constituency of lawyers, C-level executives, and Wall Street speculators. And then Greg says, how do we create a party whose interest group is the American people? Let us hold those. Andy in Des Moines, West Des Moines, Iowa. Andy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a couple comments because, I'm actually a pretty young. I'm 24 years old. I'm a liberal, but I consider myself a reluctant Democrat, and a part of that is exactly the conversation that you're having with the author. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, I can look at the Democratic Party, and they rail against money in politics and taking big money, taking contributions from these big money contributors,
right,
like Wall Street, and they just, it's a total two-face about the whole thing. Specifically they're saying about Mitt Romney being a venture capitalist, but then they open up their arms, the venture capitalist money. Yeah, it's just, to me, it's just totally hypocritical.
So, but who's closer to the national interest, or is anybody at this point, in your view, Andy?
In my view, I consider myself going with the lesser of two evils and going with the Democratic Party, but my point is that it's particularly hypocritical because they're, not much better than the Republican Party. I think that Republican Party probably, and we're going to see it this election like no other, with these outside super PAC groups. People can write, $5 million check. We saw it in the Republican primaries. People were just writing, $5 million checks, $10 million checks. That's just, it's disgusting.
But you've got discomfort on both sides of that, and we hear it, Andy. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Rowley, Massachusetts. Danby. Hi, Danby. You're on the air.
Hi, I was just thinking the premise of this guy is all wrong. People speak to the Democrats because the Democrats will listen. If I call a Republican legislator about an African-American issue or an environmental issue, their staff will just shut down on me, won't even talk. If I call a Democrat, they'll engage in a conversation. So I don't think they're pandering to the spoiled, rotten Democrats. I think that's just the people that will respond to our concerns.
Danby, we've got it. Jay Koss, let me bring that to you. They're not pandering. They're representing. They're listening.
Right. Well, first of all, let me say to one of your Twitter commenters, mm-hmm, that, the idea that, I do not see anybody here as being a bad guy, organized labor, environmentalists, feminists. I mean, I think
But you
that
say the they're, point, the, in total, they're a threat to the American Republic through the party.
No,
your book.
Well, no, they are not no. The problem, the challenge, the threat is the management of these interests, balancing the needs of these interests with the demands of the public good. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would not argue it at all that these people stand athwart the public good. It's just that there are tensions and challenges to managing individual needs and demands and wants with the needs, demands, and wants of everybody. So there are no bad guys in my story.
If there are no bad guys, then give us an example of how this pushes toward the demise of the Republic. What do you mean?
Right. Well, I mean, I think a great example of it is sort of an example of also the grassroots, but the Democratic leadership's double talk. And Mark mentioned this earlier, and one of your callers mentioned the pharmaceutical industry being a client of the Republican Party, and that's certainly the rhetoric of the Democratic Party. But when it was time to cut a deal with Big Pharma,
You mean in George Bush's Medicare change?
With Obamacare. Now, the president, as a candidate in 2008, actually run a campaign ad, a good campaign ad, I thought, blasting George W. Bush and Billy Towson for cutting a deal with Big Pharma, and then Towson going to lead Big Pharma. Right. It was a good ad. Yep. And it, like I said, it really spoke to this sense that I had of Obama as a candidate, that he was looking to push through this. But when it came time to put the bill together, the White House was very nervous about Big Pharma and whether or not they would oppose him. So Obama actually cut a deal very similar to the one that George W. Bush cut with Billy Towson, which is why the health care bill does not include the reimportation of Canadian drugs from Canada. It was excluded in a deal that was cut with pharma. In exchange, pharma would support the bill and run advertisements and so on and so forth, and also contribute however many tens of billions of dollars in free drugs. In other words, the point of this is to sort of peel back the rhetoric of both political parties and look at what they do behind closed doors. And you can see there's a real distinction there. And that's sort of another reason that I wrote the book.
A distinction. I'm listening for that. Between the two parties? But you're saying it's on both sides?
No. A distinction between the rhetoric.
Or the public. In the private.
The public-spirited rhetoric of the two parties that we sort of read in the two-party platforms compared to what is actually happening behind closed doors.
Chris in Augusta, Georgia. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to keep it current by talking about Big Pharma right now. I'm glad you brought up that point, because lobbying is not representation. He's talking about the fall of American Republic. Republic means representation. So, the Democrats and the Republicans are both guilty of that. The Occupy movement notices that. I think there's a lot of Democrats out there because it's not the Republican Party, and that's it. The original reason I called was because you guys first started talking about the
beholden to interest, not you know.
Thank you. The quote interest groups of the Democratic Party, and they all had a similar theme to me. It kind of spoke out with a contrast. Was you have the feminism, a.k.a. women's rights. Women still get paid a lot less than men for the same job. Mm-hmm. Then you had the unions, which is the workers, the working class people, because the corporations have to bow down to them. They hate that. Well, the Republican Party is bowing down to the corporations. Of course they hate that. Then you've got the EPA. The EPA is restricting and regulating a lot of the big oil, big manufacturing companies, again, corporations that the Republicans and Democrats both bow down to through lobbying. So, yeah, if we have interest groups, at least they're the interests of the people. It may not be the majority. I don't care if it's 30% or 51%, but at least it's the people. And it's not the rich people or the lobbyists or the born-into-wealth people.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Jay Cost, if the Democratic Party has interest, at least it's the people and not just corporate interest. What do you say?
Well, I think, like I said, I think there's a very fine line, and I'd sort of maybe answer that question with an example, an old example. When Harry Truman took office in 1945, you know, he faced the challenge of demobilization from World War II and with it rampant inflation. And what organized labor was endeavoring to do after the war was they wanted to keep inflation under control, but also, have major wage increases. In other words, they were looking for a fundamental transformation of the American political economy, which I'm not my criticism here. The point, however, is that organized labor started striking in 1946 and into 47, and the strikes eventually threatened the railroad industry, and which would have shut down the entire economy. And Truman gives a very fiery speech denouncing L. Vanley Johnson and the other labor leader who was sort of leading the strike and sort of threatening to draft the striking workers into the armed forces, because this, you know, organized labor cannot shut down the American economy. However, Congress passes the Case Bill, which would have accomplished many of the things that Truman himself said needed to happen. But Truman needed organized labor in advance of the 1948 election, and so he vetoed the Case Bill. And despite all of his strong rhetoric during his first term, and despite, frankly, the social irresponsibility of organized labor striking like that and threatening to shut down the entire American economy, the only major labor reform of the Truman period was the Taft-Hartley Bill, which, of course, was passed over his veto. That's a great example of what I'm talking about, and it's so my position is not sort of like, you know, organized labor's interests are inherently different from the national interest. But the point, though, is that sometimes they are. Sometimes they deviate. That's just the nature of the collective action dilemma of politics.
Of course, in the years since then, the labor membership has fallen so dramatically that it hardly
seems... Yes, it has.
Well,
but
today.
Amazingly, though, organized labor, even as its membership has dropped from something like 30% of the workforce down to about 12% and actually under 10% of the private sector workforce, you know, the organized labor's position within the Democratic Party has actually improved over the years. And, you know, one of the things that was so illustrative to me during the healthcare debate was that the interest group that gave the green light to pursuing the healthcare bill as it was finally passed after Scott Brown's victory in Massachusetts was organized labor. And the reason they gave the green light was not for some grand ideological goal, but the understanding that they could kill the so-called Cadillac tax via budget reconciliation, which was a real stumbling point for organized labor. Mm-hmm. And which, by the way, is a great example of the challenges that I'm talking about. You know, healthcare costs are going out of control, and a lot of it has to do with these platinum-plated, insurance policies. Well, organized labor over the years has really negotiated such policies for their workers because they're tax-free, and it would be a great way to control costs. But organized labor didn't want their members taxed like that, so they weighed on, you know, people like Charlie Rangel on ways and means to kill that.
I guess it all depends where you look. You can look at oil industry subsidies, or you can look at union contracts and healthcare coverage. We're talking with Jay Cost. His book is Spoiled Rotten. Mark Hetherington, I want to get your perspective here. Let me get a couple callers, and they'll come right to it. Michael in New Haven, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that, you know, the premise of this book seems, to me, no insult to the author, ridiculous. It's like saying school buses are yellow. Both parties are beholden to people with deep pockets. Both parties are guilty of the same thing, and both parties are taking us in the same direction. I just think the Republicans are going to get us there faster.
Michael,
go to corporations for the money.
I got it, Michael. Our time is short. One more, Marilyn in Sewanee, Tennessee. Marilyn, you're on.
Yes, I am a social worker, and what I can tell you without any equivocation is that the Democratic Party is our only hope to take care of working class people and the poor. It's historically always been that way. You know, I personally would like Mitch McConnell's number one agenda to be to work for me, not to not get the president reelected. And the reason I think the Democratic Party is not more successful is because they try to be reasonable. And when you're reasonable, you don't tend to get things done, it seems, in our country or in our government.
Marilyn, our time is short, but reasonable, you get run over. Mark Hetherington, what about that? Here's Marilyn, social worker, you know, says, hey, she's listening to Jay, but she says this Democratic Party's our only hope, she says, for working people in this country. How do you parse that, Mark?
Well, I think everybody sees politics from the perspective that they come from. But one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind here is, you know, one of the things I worry about a little bit as far as the book is concerned is, you know, whether this is a continuation of the sort of Karl Rove, you know, politics on one level or another, and that is attacking people or a party in this case on the grounds that they're strongest and that you're weakest. As, you know, has come across during the course of this conversation, most people, you know, view the Republicans as more beholden to special interests, but Democrats is beholden to special interests as well. But let's face it, that's politics. You know, why do we end up with the deal with Big Pharma at the end of the healthcare thing? It's to get 60 votes in the Senate, and that's necessary in order to get things passed. But again, it is a question of degree, I think, in many respects. And to suggest that the parties are, you know, similar in that respect, especially as it relates to interests like corporate interests, you just have to look at the fundraising totals to suggest that and the support of the super PACs and things along those lines to suggest that there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case.
Jay, we've just got a minute. What would you do to change things for the better that might address these issues in both parties?
Well, first of all, I think campaign finance reform, I think that goes without saying.
How do you do that after Citizens United?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure how that gets done. I would like to see some sort of change, some sort of limitation. But, you know, more than anything, I think what we need is term limits in Congress. You know, if members of Congress are not there as long, it's more difficult for them to be captured by special interests and thus less likely. Because, of course, there's a sort of, like I said, there's a tension here. There's a tension between the sort of the partisan narrative that both sides puts out and that you see in opinion columns and all that. And then there's what happens behind closed doors in this subcommittee of that committee and that subcommittee. And I'd like to see those places cleaned out. Both sides, I think, are really could use term limits. I do not believe the 535 people who currently reside in the United States Congress are so essential to the survival of the country that we can't have term limits.
Jay, we've got it. Mark Hetherington at Vanderbilt University. Mark, first to you, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Jay Kost, author of Spoiled Rotten, How the Politics of Patronage Corrupted the Once Noble Democratic Party and Now Threaten the American Republic. Jay, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much.
An excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We end our hour today with a thought for the great Mexican novelist Carlos Fuentes. He died yesterday at 83. Fuentes is one of Mexico's great public intellectuals, one of the most admired writers in the Spanish-speaking world. The death of Artemio Cruz, his 1962 novel about injustice in post-revolutionary Mexico, brought him international acclaim. Many American readers know him for The Old Gringo, his book that was later made into the 1989 film starring Gregory Peck and Jane Fonda. And for one day, March 19th, 2011, Carlos Fuentes tweeted. His final post on Twitter that day was this, translated from Spanish to English: "There must be something beyond slaughter and barbarism to support the existence of mankind, and we must all help search for it." We spoke with Carlos Fuentes last year about his most recent novel, Destiny and Desire, just after it was released in English. To listen back to our conversation, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.